are two extremes of the range that we see today, and this is very interesting to test our theoretical models. So let me first start with a brief introduction on, in general, on what we do with black holes and quasars. Quasars were the way supermassive black holes were discovered first in the 60s for objects like 3C273, which is shown here. This is an object that was point-like, so star-like, and it was really a revelation when it was realized that this was a cosmological object. The luminosity of this quasar is comparable to the luminosity of an entire galaxy, but the size is pretty much the size of the solar system. So this was really a revolution in a few years ago. But then, later on in time, between the 90s and now, a huge population of black holes that are not quasars have now been discovered. Now, the clear case, as you all know, is Sagittarius A star. This is a radio image. And now we know that many black holes are really quiescent. So while quasars are active black holes that are accreting gas, this gas is spiraling in, going through the last stable orbit, and emitting radiation on its way to the center, there are black holes, many of them, that are really quiescent. So for instance, in the case of the Milky Way, so Sagittarius A star, the black hole in the Milky Way, the luminosity is really comparable to the luminosity of the sun. So we have these two extremes, quasars that have luminosity of an entire galaxy, and black holes that have luminosity of a normal star. So when I think of black holes in the universe, I really love to compare these two images. On the right-hand side here, we have the Hubble deep field. So here what we're seeing is starlight. Each of the dots there is a galaxy. Some of these galaxies may host black holes. These black holes will, for most part, be quiescent black holes, like Sagittarius A star. On the right-hand side, we see the Chandra deep field. So here it's an X-ray image, and each of the dots here is instead of a quasar or an AGN. So here we are really comparing the population of quiescent black holes that we don't often see at optical wavelengths, and quasars and AGN. Now, if you do, if you look at this figure, you could probably start imagining this is the same image. This is the same patch of the sky. So if you go and count carefully how many galaxies correspond to AGN, you find that not all galaxies correspond to AGN. Indeed, what we know is that about 1% to 10% of galaxies host a black hole, which is an inactive phase. And the questions that we have, one of the many questions that we have is, do all galaxies host black holes, and these black holes become active, AGN and quasars, for a short amount of time, or do only a few galaxies, a small percentage of galaxies, host a black hole, and this black hole is active most of the time? Now, we can make some inferences already today, but this is not a very clear question. So what we really want to know is, what is the connection, what is the relationship between the growth of black holes in galaxies and the growth of the galaxies themselves? And this brings us to the field of the cosmological evolution of black holes, and how do we actually get this sort of picture. So let me just give you an idea about, do we have a laser pointer, sorry? Oh. Okay, I will use my hand. To put things in the context of galaxies and black holes, here I have a cartoon of the Milky Way. And here I just want to highlight really the sizes and the physical scales that characterize galaxies and black holes, and what is the challenge in my field. So here you have a galaxy. You see here the dark matter halo, the galactic bulge, which is made of stars, the disk, which is made of gas. Now, if we look here at the physical scales characterizing them, the dark matter halo has a scale of about megaparsecs. Now, it's not, the important part here is not the parsec, the definition of parsec, but that you have a mega here. Then we go to the bulge, so the stellar component of the galaxy, and here we go to kiloparsecs, so a factor of 1,000 less. When we put a black hole in there, things become much, much different. The black hole is characterized by three main scales. The Bondi scale, which defines the region within which the gas dynamics is dominated by the black hole, and it's about parsec scale, so another factor of 1,000. Same for the sphere of influence, which is where the star dynamics is dominated by the black hole. And then we get to the Schwarzschild radius, which is microparsec. So when we study the evolution of black holes in galaxies, we are trying really to connect what happens on megaparsec scales, the cosmological setup, which is how the galaxy grows, to parsec and microparsec scales, so at least 12 orders of magnitude that we have to cover. So this makes things rather complicated. Now, I want like you to keep in mind for a few more minutes these scalings. That we have that the galaxy is characterized by scales of kiloparsecs and black hole by parsec to microparsec scales. Because this is one of the puzzles, let's say, that have to do with the correlation between black holes and galaxies. A few years ago, starting in the late 90s, it was realized that the masses of the quiescent black holes that we see in nearby galaxies, and now the sample is about 80 galaxies, I think that Kaihan will talk a bit more about this sample. For these about 80 galaxies and 80 black holes, it was found that the masses of black holes are not random. They correlate with the mass of the central bulge, which in the previous slide was shown as an orange dot. Typically, you know, throughout the rest of this talk, you can think the mass of the black hole to be a factor of 1,000 less than the mass of the galaxy. It's a simplification, but it seems okay for now. More and more correlations have been found, for instance, with the velocity dispersion, which seems to be a tighter correlation. But the whole point here is that black holes know about galaxies and vice versa. Now, here we're talking about black holes that have a physical scale of microparsec scales and galaxies that have a physical scale of kiloparsecs. So there must be a way to have for these two systems to interact. And so in the last 10 years or so, we have been asking how have these correlations been established? What is the physical mechanism that operates over six orders of magnitude and links black holes to galaxies? So to simplify this, I like to think of it in a simple way. So is this correlation regulated by the galaxy or by the black hole? In other words, is the black hole setting its own mass and the mass of the stars that you form in the galaxy to create this correlation, or vice versa, is the galaxy deciding how much mass the black hole can accrete? So in other words, we can think that the important ingredient here is the feeding. Feeding means how much gas the galaxy can convey to the black hole for it to grow. A completely different view is about feedback. Here it's the black hole that is regulating the growth, its own growth, and the growth of the galaxy by allowing its energy to couple to the gas in the galaxy. Now, if you feed a black hole with gas, you will have a large emission of energy. This energy is often sufficient to either unbind the gas in the galaxy or to heat its temperature. In either case, this affects the way the galaxy evolves. A galaxy with cold gas will behave in a very different way than a galaxy with hot gas. A hot galaxy cannot form stars. Finally, the last possibility is that everything is random. We see this correlation, but it's only just an average that we see over many galaxies. Now, I just want to show you a couple of movies of cosmological simulations that really show this interaction between feeding and feedback. The first one shows the merger of two galaxies. Here you see two spiral galaxies. Each of them is very similar to the Milky Way. And you see here at the center of the galaxy a flickering light. This flickering light is proportional to the luminosity that you see from the black hole in the center. Now, you see here this cosmic dance, the galaxies get together. At pericenters, the galaxies are perturbed. A large amount of gas flows to the center. And here, pay attention to what really happens to this flickering light and what happens to the galaxy itself. Now, here, this is gas, mostly in stars. The stars that you see here are in red. The blue is gas. Throughout this process, you have seen first that the quasar has increased its luminosity by several orders of magnitude. So you have fed the black hole. At the same time, the energy emitted by the black hole has coupled to the energy in the galaxy, and the remnant that you see here is not exactly the same galaxy that you saw at the beginning. So this is feedback in action. Now, this is a specific case, galaxy mergers, where really you see inflows that are triggered by the dynamical effects. Now, for a normal galaxy, and here we're seeing a cosmological simulation showing the growth of a Milky Way galaxy as a function of cosmic time. Here you see very early times. These are proto-galaxies. They're all very tiny. Some of them have black holes. Some of them don't. And you see how they evolve within this greenish background. This is cosmic gas. So here the color coding is that green is gas, stars where they form are blue, and then they turn red as they age. But so here you really see these streams of gas permeating the intergalactic medium. You see galaxies evolving as a function of time. So here you're starting seeing the main progenitor of the Milky Way evolving. You see galaxy mergers taking place. Well, these are protogalactic mergers because all the galaxies are tiny. You see here the formation of a disk. You just conserve angular momentum. You're stuck with that. And here you start seeing interesting effects. This is a major merger that probably for the Milky Way happened last at redshift 2. Now, you see here already the formation of the bulges, so these reddish spheroidal regions, that is the regions where really the masses correlate with the black holes. And then later on, you see that the galaxy keeps on evolving for a very long time, for the Milky Way, a really long time. The last major merger was redshift 2, meaning several billion years ago. The galaxy reacquires its galactic disk just because gas cools down and conserves its angular momentum. It's a very simple process. And here, for the Milky Way, we really think that the last several years have been very quiescent. And in fact, the black hole is very known to be extremely quiescent. But from this story, we think that it has grown in mass, at least in the past. And now this movie goes on with this for a few more billion years, so I will stop the movie. And I will move to the next effect that I discuss. So here we're really seeing feeding. So the gas going into the galaxy and eventually from the galaxy to the black hole. I'm not talking here about this specific process. It's been discussed for the last 30 years. We don't have a solution yet. But let me talk about feedback here. So this is an argument that I took from a review by Andy Fabian, 2012. It's a very nice argument, very clean. So I will propose to you here. So we start with the simple fact that the mass of black holes are typically a factor of 1,000 less than the mass of the galaxy. This is an observational fact, or at least an empirical fact. Now, we also know how much energy the black hole has released for during its growth. The energy is simply the mass of the black hole C squared with a factor of about 0.1, which is the relative efficiency. So one can easily calculate and compare this energy to the binding energy of the entire galaxy, which will scale with the mass of the galaxy and the velocity dispersion squared. Now, the velocity dispersion, just think of it as the sound speed for stars. Now, the velocity dispersion for most galaxies is less than 400 kilometers per second. In the case of the Milky Way, it's about 100. So when we compare the energy required released by the black hole during its growth to the binding energy of the galaxy, we have a simple factor, 10 to minus 4, and the rest scales with the ratio between the speed of light and this velocity dispersion. Which will always be much less than the speed of light. And so the binding energy of the galaxy is a factor of 80 less than the energy released by the black hole. So without saying that all the energy from the black hole actually went into the galaxy, the main point and that was done here in several papers but reviewed here in a very nice way, if even a small fraction of this energy can be transferred to the gas, then we will have a very strong effect of the galaxy. So this is the difference between feeding, the galaxy being able to send gas to the black hole, and feedback, the black hole affecting its own galaxy. Now, keeping all these processes in mind, let's see how the black holes and the galaxy grew over cosmic time. We start in the early universe and we get to today. So how do black holes grow to become supermassive? We have two main processes, black hole mergers, and gas accretion. When you have a galaxy merger, you may have a black hole merger afterwards. Now, the interesting point here is that suppose now that all black holes in the universe grew only by merging with other black holes. The total mass in black holes in the universe is constant. You just change the distribution of the masses. The second way black holes grow in mass is accretion. So when the galaxy provides some gas for that growth. And accretion is when black holes become Aegean quasars. Now, we can use an argument called the Soltan's argument to compare these two scenarios and see what is the leader in growing black hole masses. Now, these Soltan arguments just started from the luminosity function of quasars. A luminosity is energy per unit time, so integrate over time, you get the total energy density, and you can rescale an energy density to a mass density with a factor of c squared. So in this way, you can calculate the mass density of black holes as a function of cosmic time. And you see here black holes grew in mass by a factor of 10 in the last 10 giga years. So accretion here leads because the total mass density has grown with time. So now this is the global history. But what can we say about mergers, black hole mergers? Are they ever important? Now, this is a statistical study. This is the average for all black holes in the universe. Now, we can go and simulate the growth of black holes in cosmological simulations like those that we showed you before, and theoretically estimate what is the fraction of mass for black holes of different masses that is given by black hole mergers. Now, you see here this fraction as a function of black hole mass. So what we're seeing here is that high-mass black holes, 10 to the 9 solar masses and higher, probably had a large contribution of their growth through black hole mergers. At least, 30-40% or so. Small black holes in small galaxies, like the Milky Way, had a completely different evolution. And most of their growth is really given by accretion. So with Sagittarius A star and the M87, we're probing the two extremes of this range. The last point that I want to make, and I think I have time for that, is what is the typical black hole spin? Now, Shep gave a perfect introduction to this. Black holes have mass, but they have spin as well. And what is the spin that we expect for black holes? Now, this will really depend on the way black holes grew. If black holes grew only by black hole mergers, we expect an asymptotic value of the black hole spin that is 0.7 or so. If black holes grew by accretion, it's much more complicated. It's a process of angular momentum sum, basically. If the disk is prograde, you have two vectors, two angular momenta that sum each other, so you increase the black hole spin. Vice versa, if the angular momentum vectors are anti-aligned, you decrease the black hole spin. So you can expect different scenarios, an accretion that could be coherent, so you sum all the angular momentum, or chaotic, you have very different angular momentum. So in this case, you can see in this other simulation of the cosmological evolution of black holes what I mean by chaotic and coherent. So here the orange line, don't look at the other colors, shows the direction of the angular momentum of the gas accreted by the black hole. Now, if this is constant, it means that the angular momentum vector is always pointing in the same direction. When it's changing wildly, the angular momentum vector changes as well. And here you see the accretion rate on the black holes. So what you're seeing here is that throughout the history of black holes, you change from different phases of accretion, those that grow coherently, the black hole spin, and those they don't. So, So I will just put this in the context of M87 and the Milky Way. So these are two very different black holes. As I said, they are at the two extremes of the mass range that we know today. They have both very low accretion rates. And the questions that you can ask and probably answer with the Event Horizon Telescope is, what can we say about the growth of their mass? Have mergers played a role or not? And here I will, this is my last slide, and I'm just speculating wildly, very wildly, on what we can say. Especially spin of black holes, that is very hard to measure. I'm sorry that Jeff is not giving the talk because he would say it very nicely. If black hole mergers grew large black holes like M87, we expect a spin, an equilibrium spin of about 0.7. If accretion is important instead, we may have a more interesting life. So a Sagittarius A star and M87 in their spins may really keep track of what process helped them grow. And I will stop here on this speculation and, well, help me speculate even more. Thank you. In the whole universe?
Yes.
People have measured our black hole masses above 10 to the 10. This is expected. For me, what was a surprise? I was not expecting such big black holes. I find it hard to understand because, 10 to the 10 solar masses is the whole stellar mass of the Milky Way. So you have to feed an entire galaxy to a black hole to grow it so much. So I'm still surprised. You have enough time, you have 13 billion years, so probably you can get a black hole which is much larger than that, just based on cosmic time. You probably can get 13 billion solar masses, just one solar mass per year. How do you get this gas? That's my question. I really don't know how you can feed a black hole so much mass.
Jeff would hear talk about these 0.99 black holes. They're more stellar mass. Following on Eduardo's question, what is the highest spin you would expect to see for the supermassive black hole?
Theoretically, just GR would tell you it's 0.998 or something like that for a thin disk surrounding a black hole. Now, statistically, which is probably the question that is more interesting here, we have Charles Gummy here. I think he should answer this question. Statistically, we expect that accretion on black holes will not lead actually to spin as high as that, but more like 0.9. If you ask me what is the maximum spin, the theoretical maximum is 1. The expected maximum for a spin disk is 0.998. The expected maximum for some slim disk is 0.9998. The expected maximum from the cosmic evolution is about 0.9-ish or so. And this is just because it's extremely hard. And I think, again, Charles has done the simulations showing the growth of the spin in an accretion disk to get to the maximum value. If you have black hole mergers dominating, then you can get totally to 1, and maybe Luciano Rezzolla will give you the right answer because he did the simulations for that. So I'm giving credit to the actual people who did the work.
And how well does the Milky Way fit this black hole bulge correlation?
It's a bit undermassive.
Bit?
Undermassive.
A bit? 3 orders of magnitude?
No. No, no, no. It was on the plot that I showed you before. So it's not 3 orders of magnitude.
What is the mass of the Milky Way?
The mass of the bulge of the Milky Way.
Yeah.
So you don't have to take the mass of the whole Milky Way. I'm sorry, but my laptop is not, it's actually underneath. I can show you the plot later on, but it's not 3 orders of magnitude.
How many
Kahan? Yeah. We have worse beasts in that. We have cases that are two orders of magnitude off, rather than the Milky Way.
The bigger question is,